As I got a little bit of the ball, she'd already started to swing and just kept on swinging and followed through and caught me right on the jaw. And I knew immediately I'd done something horrendous. I could just feel all the teeth, bottom set of teeth on my left-hand side, just pop up. And I heard the crowd. It's funny when you remember the crowd in the corner all was like a pantomime. We're like...
Welcome to Celebrating Connections, a short series of podcasts celebrating the amazing things happening on either side of the North Sea. My name is Nick Heath, and I'm Britain's Deputy Ambassador to the Netherlands. I'm helping to prepare a landmark state visit by King Willem-Alexander and Queen Maxima to London. But alongside the pomp and the splendour, the carriages, the speeches and the parades of soldiers, it strikes me that what makes this friendship an indispensable partnership is broader than royalty or governments. It's about thousands of human stories, or connections, crisscrossing the North Sea. In this series, I'll be meeting a group of exceptional people who are writing a new chapter in Anglo-Dutch relations. Dutch people living and working in the UK, and British people making a name for themselves here. And I'll be exploring with them what it takes to move from the countries they grew up in and thrive in the countries they've come to call home. So my guest today is the most capped British hockey player of all time. 17 years playing for Great Britain and England, 13 of them as captain. She played in 4 Olympics, scored 49 goals, and won 19 medals in international competitions. She led the GB team that won the Olympic gold in Rio in 2016, defeating the world number one Dutch team. And she's played for several periods of her career for clubs in the Netherlands. Kate Richardson-Walsh, it's an absolute pleasure to meet you.
Thank you very much.
So let's start, if we may, with a few quick fire questions.
Right.
We're meeting today in London, but I want to know which side of the North Sea has rubbed off on you a bit more since you've spent time in both. So first up, coffee or tea?
Oh, that is a tricky one. I'm going to go tea.
Okay. Not just time of day, just generally tea.
Tea, you've got the whole range. You've got your English breakfast, you've got your fruit teas, your peppermint tea.
That's a strong tea. It's a strong tea, I like that. Okay. All right. So you're a Man U fan, right?
Yes,
okay.
I am.
Okay, so Louis van Gaal or David Moyes?
Oh, my goodness. That's a difficult one. Neither of them obviously were that successful.
Neither of them's Fergie, right?
So. Yeah, both great managers. I think Louis van Gaal's got probably a bit more about him. It's a good personality. It'd be interesting to meet him, I think.
All right, we'll see if we can make that happen. Jaffa cakes or strop waffles?
Oh, strop waffles. Yeah, every time. They are just too delicious. Once you open a packet, they're all gone.
It's not going to happen.
They're
yet.
All
Very
gone.
Good. All right, Amsterdam Pride or Brighton Pride?
Ooh, I mean, Amsterdam Pride on the canals with everyone on the boats and... It's pretty good.
It's pretty spectacular.
Yeah, it's
isn't
hard
it?
To beat that.
Yeah. Running or cycling?
Oh, goodness. I don't really enjoy running. Although where I live now, there's no way I'm getting on a bike because it's really hilly in North London. cycling in the Netherlands is, I just don't think you can beat it. It's flat and there are great cycle lanes. But because of where I live now, I'm going to have to go running, unfortunately.
There you go. It's quite a balanced set of answers, actually. Although strong Dutch influence there.
Yes.
I think. Yes, very much. All right. So, look, I'd like to start by just talking a little bit about your international career because it kind of, you know, obviously it's extremely long and successful, and it also plays against the Netherlands kind of repeatedly, really, throughout that, right? So let me take you back to the 19th of August 2016. Mm. It's the Olympic gold medal match. You're playing the Dutch, who are the number one team in the world. It's probably fair to say you're underdogs in that situation. Mm-hmm. You're captain. What do you say to the team to pump them up?
Oh, they didn't need pumping up that day. It's Olympic final. It's once in a lifetime opportunity. I mean, the Dutch, absolutely world number one. They're going for their third gold medal in a row. And they had the pressure on them. And I think they definitely felt that. I think they had a very close semi-final against Germany, which also went to penalties. So we felt confident. We've had belief, but we knew that the pressure was on them, which helped us inevitably. And so I think for me as a captain, all I needed to say was just go and do your job. The same as you've done every single game. This was our 8th game in 14 days and we'd won the previous 7. So we felt like we were really in good form and on a roll, and it was just a case of trying to weather the storm because we knew that they were going to have a good number of chances and we'd need a little bit of luck to go our way. And it did, fortunately.
And when it came down to the penalties at the end, I mean, is there the same sort of superstition in hockey as there is in England football that penalties only go one way and it's not England's way? I mean, is it the same sort of feeling with Team GB in hockey?
I think we've it's probably about 50-50 split, I guess, in my career. If I look back, when we've won penalties, when we haven't, I think the team and the preparation for the penalties in Rio was the best we'd ever had. They'd been practicing for years, and they'd been practicing on different turfs with different sticks against different goalkeepers, under fatigue, under pressure, under stress. And that's the goalkeepers and the takers. And we had about 8 or 10 takers in the whole squad of 31 that had been prepared, and those 5 were our best takers. So we were as ready as we could have been.
Were you any more nervous when it was your wife who was taking one of those, or was it just the same all the way through?
I think I just felt the same the whole way through. I mean, we're so good at kind of switching into hockey mode and then separate private life, personal mode. And maybe there was a little bit of extra nerves. I think she had to take a running penalty, so the penalty shuffle, and she also had to take a penalty stroke, which is more like a penalty in football because one of our players was fouled and she's the nominated taker. And I guess that was maybe when the nerves, because it's such a different setting, a penalty flick, normally it's silent, it's just you and the goalkeeper, it's still, there's that eeriness of that moment. And but she just owned it, she was amazing.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
And do you remember, how did you celebrate afterwards?
The first night, I mean, the initial celebrations were just wild. We were just screaming and singing and dancing, and I completely think we all just lost ourselves for a few hours. And that night was quite quiet. Our psychologist, Andrea First, had arranged for all our friends and family that travelled to meet the team and all our management on top of I think it was a local hotel that was local to the Olympic Village. So we could all just sit and be together and without any kind of media or anybody else. And it was just a really special private moment. It wasn't loud, there wasn't music, it was a few drinks. I just wanted to sit down because I was so tired. And just say thank you to, you know, our staff, all of the reserves that were there who didn't win an Olympic medal but gave everything, all of our friends and family. And it was a really special night. The night after that was completely raucous, but it was a good balance. Yeah,
it's probably a good thing that you don't stop for playing and start drinking immediately. It's probably not a good sound.
It's a very cheap short night for us. Yeah.
And then you were selected to carry the flag right at the closing ceremony. What's that like when you walk into the stadium carrying the flag?
I often gloss over that, which is crazy because it's such an honour. But because the winning that Olympic gold medal was just felt so epic, the few days after that just feel like a bit of a blur. But that was such an incredible honour. I mean, just being told that I was, you know, had that honour, that had been selected by my fellow athletes to carry the British flag in the closing ceremony, was amazing. And particularly the fact that I thought I was being told off. I got called to see the chef de mission in his apartment in our tower block in Rio, and I thought, because it was after our raucous night out, that one of the girls had done something horrendous and I was, you know, going to have to go and grovel and apologise. And then, you know, he said, you're going to carry the flag, and I just burst out crying. And I think the most special thing representing that group of athletes, the whole of Team GB, who'd been so successful, the most successful ever. We'd backed up an amazing Olympics in London 2012. It's never been done before. And so to go out there and represent our country and hold that flag proud was just really, really special moment.
Wow, okay. And then it's quite a transformation, right? Because only 2 years before, you guys had gone to the World Championships in The Hague, right? And come joint last, I think, in that competition.
Yeah.
Dutch had won it again.
Yeah.
You know, to go from that to Olympic champions, what changed? How did the team change over 2 years to make that happen?
I mean, there were a lot of things. The 2 years after London, we had a lot of change. We had a change of coach. We had a change of team, which always happens after Olympics. Change of culture. And we just lost our way a little bit. I don't think I'd been completely respectful of what we'd created in that lead up to London. And although we were kind of eyes open, arms open to the change, we just didn't manage that change particularly well. And we did okay the year after the London Olympics. We won a silver medal at the European Championships. We beat the Netherlands on penalties, actually, in the semi-final, but then lost the final to Germany. And then 2014, it just started to erode. It was not a nice place to be for any of us, management, players, everybody. And we went from being a really selfless team to quite a selfish team, and everybody kind of in it for themselves. And all of us were struggling and didn't really know how to grip it. And our old coach from the London cycle, Danny Kerry, who's now the men's GB coach, he came back in and basically set about to do what exactly as he'd done before London. He empowered the group, he gave us the ownership, he made us responsible, and we ran with it. And we were now hurting And, you know, when you're hurt, you're prepared to go to great lengths to make sure you get what you want. And for a lot of that team, it was our last chance and our biggest and greatest chance to go and achieve our dream. So we put everything out there.
And you mentioned London 2012. You had quite a tournament, London 2012. Do you want to talk me through what happened?
Oh, it's one of those moments. I don't really like having regrets, but yeah, the first game against Japan. So first game, London 2012, home Olympic Games. We've been practicing on that pitch for a year, I think, beforehand. And we were winning 4-0 against Japan. 4 minutes to go. It was kind of dream start to the Olympics. And me being competitive, went in for a tackle against the Japanese right winger. You know, interestingly for me, I got a bit of the ball, which never normally happens. And as I got a little bit of the ball, she'd already started to swing and just kept on swinging and followed through and caught me right on the jaw. And I knew immediately I'd done something horrendous. I could just feel all the teeth, bottom set of teeth on my left-hand side just pop up. And I heard the crowd. It's funny when you remember the crowd in the corner all was like a pantomime. We're like, And I knew I'd done something really bad, and I thought that was my Olympics over. And I went to go to hospital, have scans, and they said, yeah, that's it, that's your Olympic Games over. And I just remember sitting up the whole night because I couldn't lie down because lots of blood was going down the back of my throat. So I sat up the whole night and just cried. And then the next morning, like an absolute guardian angel, Mr. Holmes came in, the surgeon, and said, I think we can fix you, Kate. And I think we can get you back on the pitch. And I was just like, I'm not sure about this. But he seems very confident, so I'm going to go with it. So I had surgery that day, put in a couple of metal plates, stitched it all up internally in my mouth. And slowly but surely over the period, I think it was 4 days, I managed to get myself back out and back onto the pitch.
So 4 days between breaking your jaw and playing again.
Yeah, I watched the next game they played, the GB team played against South Korea. I watched it in hospital. I'd had my surgery and that was such an amazing game to watch. They won 5-3, I think it was, or 5-2. Just an amazing game. The crowd just sounded electric. And then they beat Belgium, and I sat on the bench for the Belgium game. And then I came back, and then we lost to China. We lost to the Dutch, and then we lost the semi-final to Argentina. So I was feeling particularly low at this point because I thought I was the bad omen. But then fortunately we beat New Zealand in the bronze medal game and got home with the bronze medal. Yeah.
And I mean, I remember London in 2012. It was an extraordinary time to be in the city. Mm. What did it mean to you playing in your home country in Olympic Games?
Everything. I think for lots of us, you know, we do have great support from our friends and family, but they can't travel to all the places that we go to. And this was a time when all of our friends and family could be there. And so to have that support in the stadium was special. And then to have a really mixed crowd, actually, because Olympic crowds are, you know, people just wanted to get tickets to see any sport. And it made the crowd much noisier than a hockey crowd. Right. Normally a hockey crowd, quite polite, a bit like a Wimbledon tennis crowd. But they were noisy and they were making just so much support for the GB team. And everything that was around, so lucky that the hockey venue was in the Olympic Park. So you could hear the kind of atmosphere from all the other venues and people spilling out from all the venues and just the vibe and the volunteers and spectators. It was just so upbeat. And we missed quite a lot of it. When you're at the Olympics, you kind of miss the Olympics. So 2 weeks later, we had the Paralympics and went to go and watch that. And I went to watch the swimming. And just to hear when the GB swimmers were coming out, it was just the most incredible feeling ever and something I'll never, ever forget for the rest of my life.
Spectacular. So obviously an amazing international career, but you've also played lots of club hockey, including in Holland, right?
Yeah.
So I think I'm right in saying you've played three different clubs, Bilthoven near Utrecht, Kleine Switzerland in The Hague, and Bloemendaal after you retired from international hockey.
Yeah.
What first brought you to the Netherlands to play hockey?
So the first time I went, as a GB women's team, we'd failed to qualify for the Athens Olympic Games. So unusually, I had a whole summer with no hockey and I didn't really know what to do with myself and I was quite low. And I was then at the time in a relationship with Brett Garrard, who was in the men's GB team. And he said, yeah, why don't we go to play in the Netherlands? And not many players were doing it then, but we had a really close friend, Lawrence Doherty, who we both knew really well. And he had moved to the Netherlands quite a few years before. He's a Scottish guy. And he said, yeah, why don't you come? And Max Caldas was playing, who is now the Dutch men's coach. He was playing at the club. Alison Annan, who is now the Dutch women's coach. She was coaching Kleine Switzerland, having just retired from playing in that ladies' team. And it just seemed like a great thing for me to do. I was a bit lost. I didn't really know what to do. There was no funding. I needed to get some money from somewhere. So I decided to go out there with Brett and we coached and played and did lots of... I worked in a shop, I remember, in Den Haag. Yeah. I worked in... it was like a clothes shop a couple of days a week to make some money. And I lived on the Noreinde, which is just the most...
spectacular
beautiful
place.
Yeah. Street. I mean, a tiny, tiny top floor little apartment, but it was just the most beautiful place to live. And I loved it. I loved the hockey. I loved the team. I loved being at the club. I loved Den Haag. I loved the whole lifestyle of living in Holland. Just in that moment, just really suited me.
Tell me about living in Den Haag a bit. So, you know, did it feel like home immediately, or were there moments when you thought, God, this is a bit different?
I'm trying to think. So I think initially I lived with Lawrence, which was really near the hockey club, and that was good. We had a good party vibe. Well, Brett was at the Athens Olympics, so he was kind of there and he was training. So I spent some time with Lawrence and just got into the training and living by the club, and that was nice. But I think once we'd moved into the Noreinde and Brett was there, I think we really felt settled, and the club were amazing at making us feel like home. I cycled to the club. As you know, got a bike and I cycled to the club every day, and I was either giving training to the meisjes in the under 18s or some of the littler ones, and learning to speak Dutch. I went to Dutch lessons as well. So yeah, they really helped, I think, me feel at home. All of the players, everyone at the club. I don't think I could have chosen a better first step into Dutch hockey and, yeah, Dutch life.
And how is your Dutch?
Ja, ik spreek een beetje Nederlands.
Oh, well done.
Yeah.
Amazing.
It's a long time ago now. 2004, I had lessons. So it's, yeah, a lot of it stayed in. I can understand more than I can say. But it's really helpful.
When you're playing and training, do you speak Dutch like on the pitch, or would people speak English to you? What would happen?
Yeah, I mean, I felt really strongly that I really wanted to speak Dutch on the pitch, because you haven't got time to process information. The game happens so quickly, and I need to be able to understand what they're saying to me, and I need to be able to speak to them quickly. So that was the first thing that I really focused on, the hockey Dutch. And then after that, you want to know what's going on in the changing room, you know, you want to know what's happening in people's lives, and you miss so much if you don't understand. And Alison Annan, who's Australian, she was doing a lot of the team talks in Dutch, so I had to learn quickly. So each time I've gone, you know, if I'm taking particularly the younger ones and I'm coaching the little ones, I do as much as I can of it in Dutch, because I think it's important to. I'm in that country, I should learn that language.
Yeah.
I think it helped. My sister lived in the Netherlands for 10 years.
Really? Okay.
Yeah. She played at Amsterdam Hockey Club. She also played the national team. And yeah, so she speaks fluent Dutch. So that helped as well. We could text each other in Dutch and
practice it that way.
Yeah, exactly.
Brilliant. Your wife Helen came out early in her career as well, didn't she? I think to play down in Den Bosch.
Mm.
I mean, are there more and more British players coming out to play in Holland now?
Yeah, when we came out, that was 2008, so after the Beijing Olympic Games, Helen went to play at Den Bosch and I went to play at SASA. And we lived in Hintum near Den Bosch's hockey club, near the Oosterplas. And I mean, she was playing for the best team in the whole of Europe. I think they've won the European title, the club title, 13 times, or might be more. I mean, they are an incredible team, but also incredible club. And so I think for Helen to be part of that, I think they'd only ever had one international player before Helen, and that was Ornetto from Argentina. So it was really big for Helen to go there, and she became a European champion again, I think, and I think they might have just missed out on the league that season. I think they might have lost to Amsterdam, but yeah, just an amazing opportunity, and I had a similar great opportunity at SASA, and I think that then I think paved the way for other players. And I think more often there will be that crossover now, and I think part of that is because as an English-British team, I think the players are seen as good, viable options to have in your team. Certainly when I went in 2004, I think there was a bit like, you know, who are you? Where do you come from? What, England playing the World Cup? Are you sure? in the way that the great Dutch sense of humour. And but now I think they know who we are, and they know that we are a good standard. And I think hockey's changed. Fitness has become just as important as the skill side, and I think that's what maybe British players bring to a team. And now I look at the Hufflepuff and I see players from New Zealand, Australia, there's right. been American players, Irish players, Spanish players, all over the world, Argentinian players, and I think that's why it's the best league in the world, because you get a melting pot of all of these international players with the great strength and depth of Dutch hockey, and it makes for fantastic hockey.
What is the reason you think that Dutch hockey generally is so strong? What's the cause?
I think the setup, I think geography helps. So I think right. the fact that they have big clubs that are in a location that are close to people, so people can cycle. So I was coaching at Bloemendaal, the under 12s, and they were cycling half an hour to school, they'd cycle half an hour to the club, and they'd cycle home again. And they were training three nights a week at under 12. Now, you'd be lucky to get the top women's club teams in this country training twice a week. You'd really? Be lucky to do that. Then you've got under 12s playing and below and younger, you know, training two, three times a week, playing at the weekend. So it's in the blood. They've got a great system where junior hockey's on a Saturday and senior hockey's on a Sunday, and it's everyone's down at the club the whole weekend. It's part of where you live. It's part of how you grow up. It's a real safe space where everybody's welcome. You know, in Holland, we'd eat our food together after training, and then it was a real social. That's where your social setup is.
It's the cornerstone of like social life, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And we don't have that here. People are travelling hours sometimes to travel in a car, sat in traffic to get to a club training session. And there's just not that relatability. I don't think there's not that family. It is a great experience, club hockey here, but it's just different.
Yeah, that makes sense. Okay. You talked a little about coaching the under-12s there, and you've been a big advocate for participation in sport generally, right? Mm. Getting more people involved in sport. So, you know, going back to the Olympics for a moment, 2016, 9 million people watched you on TV in that final, which is an extraordinary number of people. I mean, how has playing international hockey kind of changed in terms of profile and professionalism in the course of your career?
Yeah, it's like night and day. When I look back to the profile of hockey, I think the men winning the gold medal in Seoul in 88, I think that certainly boosted hockey for a period. But we didn't have the internet then, we didn't have social media then, we didn't have the pull of the media that we do now. And so I think it was about going out there and doing our job, but then leveraging on that as much as we could. So I think they did a great job in 2012 with the scheme called Back to Hockey, so that enabled, you don't have to go and join a club, but you can go and play on an ad hoc basis whenever you can make it. And that really opened the door to lots of men and women in particular who just couldn't commit to a club team. And then off the back of, I think, Rio, we got more and more young people, I think, involved. And I think boys and girls, I think it is a real split, which is a thing I really care yeah. about. You know, I want boys and girls to be able to put on the TV, on the radio, open the newspaper, go out and see male and female
Absolutely.
Sports people playing at the very top of their game. And that seems like a normal thing for them. That's really where we all wanted to be. So the men's and the women's hockey squads are amazing at going out into schools and clubs and companies and communities and trying engaging with lots of different people playing hockey.
And is that how you keep it going between Olympics? Because obviously there's a kind of national focus on the national yeah. team Olympics, but sustaining that is hard, right?
It's really hard, yeah. Particularly in this country, in Britain, where we have, you know, lots of sports that we're so good at, and they're team sports, so cricket, rugby, football, obviously, and they all take up lots of space and lots of time, and they've all got more money and they're professional. So there's lots of other sports, you know, trying to vie for that bit of attention. So over that 4-year period, it certainly does dip. I think there are peaks. So I think the World Cup that we held in London this year, I think, was a real peak.
Yeah. Yeah.
But now with the introduction of the pro leagues, there's going to be an international league from January to July every year. And there's going to, so every week you'll be able to switch on the TV between that period and watch international hockey. So I think that's the International Federation's way of trying to keep that wave, you know, the whole way through the 4-year cycle.
Yeah, well, I hope that works. In the Netherlands, hockey can be perceived as a bit of an elite game. And in the UK, I guess, access to AstroTurfs is like hard, right? How do we improve social inclusion in hockey?
I could not agree with you more. I think hockey, quite possibly worldwide, is a middle-class sport. And I think it's middle-class white person sport. And I think we need to open our doors to mm-hmm. everybody. And part of that for me is is about access. Is it easy? Is it available? Is it affordable?
Yeah.
And so, I mean, the club that I coach now, Hampstead and Westminster, it's a council, part-owned council ground. So we, the pitch is open all the time. And, you know, that causes some issues for some people. Right. But I personally love it.
Yeah.
I absolutely love it. And I don't care what sport they're playing, just that they're out there and they're doing something. And I think that's great. And yes, you know what? Sometimes we're going to have to replace our goals a bit more often. And we're going to have to repair some nets. But that is a small price to pay for children having the opportunity to go and play sport free and whenever they want. So I think we need to be less health and safety conscious and less thinking about these small little issues and just thinking about the bigger picture and what's important for our society. And it's about everybody having the opportunity to play sport.
Yeah, yeah. OK. Talk to me about being a role model. Both, I guess it's both kind of necessary for improving inclusion and improving bringing people on, but it must also be a bit of a burden, right? Do you ever feel the burden of being a role model?
It's funny because when you start playing hockey, obviously I just wanted to be the best hockey player that I could be, and I didn't ever think about even playing for England and Great Britain to begin with, or even dare to dream about being a captain or winning an Olympic medal. I mean, that was just not even on the radar. So then to think of yourself as a role model just seems so, so very strange and alien. But I think when I really think about it, actually, everybody is a role model.
Yeah.
And everybody's got the opportunity to be a role model to the people around them. And everybody can lead. So it's, you know, it's about who do you want to be? What do you represent? What are your values? And are you bringing people along with you? And are you helping everybody else to be the best that they can be? And I think when you break it down to that, then it feels a bit less scary. And I think human, you know, I make mistakes. We all make mistakes. Nobody is perfect. And I think that authenticity and a genuine way, I think, is what people can follow, what they want to follow. And I think that's a great role model. I think we should stop. I think for young people today, they really try and put themselves up on a pedestal and find this perfection that's elusive. You're never going right. to find it. And I think it's just about being the very best version of themselves. And I think we can all, and I feel very passionate about that. So if I can help one person in some way be the very best version of themselves and find their strength, then I feel I've achieved my dream.
If a young hockey player, British hockey player, will just go and play in the Netherlands now, what advice would you give them?
Do it. Yeah, do it. If you've got the opportunity to go to the Netherlands, it is an experience you'll never forget. I think you'll learn a lot about yourself. I think you'll learn a lot about a different culture and a different way of life. And I think it'll open a lot of doors for you. I think it's a real special place to spend time, to live and to play hockey.
Well, Kate Richardson-Walsh, it's been an absolute pleasure. Such a treat to meet you. Thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
Brilliant. I'm Nick Heath, the Deputy Ambassador at the British Embassy, and you've been listening to our Celebrating Connections podcast. We'd love to know what you think of the podcast, so why not get in touch? You can reach me on Twitter, at NickHeathFCO, or you can reach the Embassy on Facebook or Twitter, both of which are at UKINNL. If you haven't subscribed already, then why not do so and get all the episodes straight to your device? And please do tell your family and friends about the show too. From me, Nick Heath, thanks for listening.